Penguin presents The Mark and the Void by Paul Murray, read by Charlie Anson.
Idea for novel. We have a banker rob his own bank. He's working alone. At first it'll look like a classic inside job. This man, however, is not what you call an insider. He's French, not Irish, and although initially he might look like a typical Parisian, black suit, expensive shoes, hair neat but worn slightly long, as the story unfolds and his past comes to light, we find out he never quite fitted in over there either. He didn't grow up in a leafy suburb, didn't attend a fancy grand école of the kind that bankers tend to come from. Instead, he spent his childhood in a rundown corner that the city prefers to disown. And his father's something blue-collar, a welder maybe, a veteran of 1968, a tough nut. The family doesn't have much. The father's job is precarious, they're constantly resorting to moneylenders, bailiffs come to take the car away, all that. But the father's ambitious for the boy. The father's determined that he'll have a better life, so the son beavers away at his third-rate school and makes it into a second-rate university, and after graduating at the top of his class, he's offered a position in a prestigious French bank. It's dull work, mostly filing and admin, but he's diligent and quick, and after a few months, his manager takes note of him and recommends him for a start in the research department. As a junior analyst, his official role is to dig up information on companies for the bank and its clients. In practice, he spends his time fixing paper jams, fetching coffees and listening politely while his boss describes his recent sexual adventures. When he gets to do his job, though, he finds that he likes it. More importantly, he's good at it. He watches money flow through the market, learns the secret influences of work on it, begins to understand how a speech made by an obscure politician in, say, Guangzhou can send stock prices soaring while a rumour about a change in the interest rate can spark a worldwide panic. He works early mornings, late nights, hour after hour in the cold glow of the screen, developing models, monitoring trades, figuring out the best way to persuade a client that he and all of his competitors have got the value of stock completely wrong. One morning, he checks his bank balance and sees he's got his first bonus, three times what his father would make in a year. That's when he knows he's made it. But his father's not happy. Instead, he looks at the trophies of his son's success, the car, the suit, the unblemished hands, and despises them. It makes no sense. This is what he wanted for him. Yet the higher the boy climbs, the angrier the old man becomes. Everything the banker does to impress him has the opposite effect. He brings little gifts to the house. The father won't accept them. He takes them for dinner. The old man won't eat. They argue incessantly, the father berating the son for things he has nothing to do with, the neighbourhood changing, the rents going up, the president being elected. He calls him a deserter, a traitor. He looks at his son and sees the emissary of a world that no longer needs him. What can the banker do? Does the old man genuinely want him to give up his job? That would be crazy, right? Besides, he likes it. He likes being wealthy and respected. He likes having a nice apartment in Auteuil and a nice new Mercedes to take him there. He likes nice meals in Le Grand Vifour and nice clothes from the Rue de Sèvres. He likes the beautiful girls who all of a sudden like him and the micro-romances they squeeze in between the market's close on Friday evening and the Monday meeting at 7 a.m. And he's his father's son. He thrives on opposition. But it gets so bad that they can't even be in the same room together. And after his mother dies, he decides he's had enough. A headhunter calls him about a position at Bank of Torbundo, a rising investment bank with a European HQ in Dublin. They want an analyst to advise clients on financial institutions, domestic and continental. His language skills make him perfect for the job. They're offering a significant increase on what he's making in Paris. He doesn't think of it as flight, nor exactly as punishment. Yes, the old man is on his own now, but if they're ever to have a functional relationship, he needs to learn something about compromise. So the son takes the job, cutting off all contact with home beyond monthly payments for the living nurse. He plans to return to Paris at Christmas and review the situation, only with a global crash he finds he's too busy to get away. Next Christmas he thinks without fail. But in April the nurse calls to tell him the old man has died in his sleep. That's how we find him as our story begins. It's a couple of months later, he's back in Dublin passing his days in the service of money, passing most of his nights that way too. He has no friends, no pastimes, no life outside the bank. He works so hard he doesn't have a moment to himself, or indeed, a self to have a moment. Someone observing might say he is depressed. He would say he wants only to be left alone. Certainly at this point he has no intention of committing a crime. Here's the thing though. Someone is observing him. For a number of weeks someone's been watching from a distance, a man dressed all in black. He makes no effort to conceal himself, nor does he make any effort to communicate. He's simply there, a supernumerary presence imprinted on the scene. He never comes closer, just watches, eyes trained on the banker as if through a gun sight. But any day now, the banker knows he'll step out of the crowd and call him by his name, And at that moment, everything will change.
That's the setup. What do you think? Will people buy it?
1. A boat ride. As a remedy to life in society, I would suggest the big city. Nowadays, it is the only desert within our means. Albert Camus.
Claude?
Yes?
What are you doing on your desk?
Me?
You're not hiding, are you?
Why would I be hiding? I say. I wait a moment, hoping that this will satisfy her, but her feet remain where they are. I'm looking for my stapler, I add.
Oh, he says.
On one ankle, between her patent leather pumps and the hem of her skirt, I glimpse a slender chain from which several small animal charms dangle. Now a pair of brown brogues approaches over the fuzzy blue carpet tiles and comes to a halt beside Ishi's pumps.
What's happening?
I hear Eugen say.
Claude's looking for a stapler, Ish says.
Oh, says Eugen, and then,
but here's his stapler directly on the desk. So it is, Ish says. Claude, your stapler's right here on your desk.
I clamber to my feet and look down to where she is pointing. Ha! I say, attempting to appear pleased and surprised.
Are you coming for lunch? Jürgen says. We are going to the hippie place.
I'm rather busy, I say.
It's casual day, Ish exhorts me. You can't eat at your desk on casual day.
I have a meeting with Walter this afternoon.
Come on, Claude, you can't live on carambars.
She grabs my arm and starts tugging me. All right, I say, reaching for my suit jacket, pretending not to notice the disapproving eye she casts over me as I put it on. Ish studied anthropology back in Australia. Casual day, one of the few rituals we have at Bank of Torabundo, is something she takes very seriously. For most of the staff, a pair of well-pressed chinos and perhaps an undone top shirt button will suffice, but Ish is wearing a low-cut top fringed with tassels and a long, multicolored skirt, also with tassels. She has even topped up her tan for the occasion, a deep, greasy brown that makes it look like she has smeared her body with patty. This image, when it occurs to me, immediately makes me nauseous, and as we descend in the lift, my stomach dips and soars like a fairground ride. I dislike casual day at the best of times. Today it spurs my paranoia to new and queasy heights. Is Kevin coming? I say to distract myself.
He went on ahead to try and get a table,
Ish says.
This whole place goes mental on casual day,
Jürgen says. At every floor, the lift stops and we are joined by more people in pressed chinos with their top shirt button undone, squeezing in beside us, sucking up the air. The crush makes my heart race. It's a relief to step through the double doors of Transaction House and into the fresh air, but only for a moment. Pastel waves of identically clad bodies are converging on the plaza from every direction. I scan the approaching faces, the bland gazes that beat against mine. Amid all the smart casual wear, a figure in black should be easy to spot, but that means I too am an obvious target. And in a freezing flash, I can picture him making his way through the sea of bodies, a cancerous cell, swimming in the innocent blood.
Thinking of getting a B-day, Ish says. For the new apartment?
Jürgen says.
Wasn't something I'd thought of initially, but the bloke from the showroom called up and said because I'm going for the full suite, they can throw in a B-day for half price. The question is, do I want a B-day? You know, at this stage I've got my toilet routine pretty much worked out.
You do not want to feel like an alien in your own bathroom, Jürgen agrees. I suppose Claude would be the expert. Claude, how much of a benefit do you think the addition of B-day would be?
You think French people do nothing else but eat baguettes and sit on their B-day, I snap. Out here, I'm finding it hard to hide my nerves. Jürgen starts telling Ish about a special toilet he has had imported from Germany. I tune him out, return to my search. Above my head, monochrome birds wheel and swoop like scraps torn from the overcast sky. How long has it been now? A week? Two? That's since I first became conscious of him, though when I think to before that, I seem to find him there too, posed unobtrusively at the back of my memories. There is no discernible pattern to his appearances. He'll be here one day, somewhere else the next. In the gloom of the morning, I might see him by the tram tracks as I make the brief synaptic journey from my apartment building to the bank. Later, bent over a pitch book with Jürgen, I'll glance out the window and spot him seated on a bench eating sunflower seeds from a packet. In the deli, in the bar, even at night when I stand on my balcony and look out over the depopulated concourse, I will seem to glimpse him for an instant, his blank gaze the mirror image of my own. The Ark is in sight now. Inside I can see the waitresses gliding back and forth, the customers eating, talking, toying with their phones. Of my pursuer there is no sign, yet with every step the dreadful certainty grows that he is in there. I stall, with a clammy mouth begin to mumble excuses, but too late, the door is opening and a figure coming straight for us.
"Full," Kevin says.
"Balls," he says.
"They're saying 15 minutes, Kevin says.
Jürgen looks at his watch.
"That would only give us 12.5 minutes to eat."
"Oh, well," I say with a false sigh, "I suppose we must go back to..."
"What about the new place?"
he says, snapping her fingers.
"Over on the other side of the square? You'll like it, Claude. It's French."
I shrug. So long as we are moving in the opposite direction to the Arc, I am happy. The French place is called Champs-Élysées. An image of the Eiffel Tower adorns the laminated sign, and on the walls inside are photographs of the Sacré-Cœur and the Moulin Rouge. Nothing about the menu seems especially Gallic. I order a mochaccino and something called a panini fromage. And while Kevin, the trainee, offers his thoughts on Ishi's lavatorial options, I sit back in my seat and try to relax. Be reasonable, I tell myself. Who would be interested in following you? Nobody is the answer. Nobody outside my department even knows I exist. This thought doesn't cheer me quite as I intended to. And the panini fromage, when it comes, only makes matters worse. It is not that the cheese tastes bad exactly, rather that it tastes of nothing. I don't think I have ever tasted nothing quite so strongly before. It's like eating a tiny black hole wrapped in an Italian sandwich. There is no way food this bad would ever be served in Paris, I think to myself, and experience a sudden stab of homesickness. How far I have come. How much I have left behind, and for what? Now, with every chew, I feel the emptiness rising inside, as if, like a kind of anti-Madeleine, the panini was erasing my past before my very eyes, severing every tie, leaving me only this grey moment, tasting of nothing. I approach the counter. The waitress's scowl appears authentically Parisian, but her accent, when she speaks, denotes the more proactive hostility of the Slav.
"Yes,"
she says, not pretending that my appearance has made her any less bored. "I think there has been a mistake," I say.
"Panini fromage," she says, "is French cheese."
"But it is not cheese," I say, "it's artificial."
"Artificial?"
"Not real." Prising apart the bread for her inspection, I point at the off-white slab sitting atop the melancholy lettuce. It resembles nothing so much as a blank piece of matter, featureless and opaque, before God's brush has painted it with the colour and shape of specificity. "I am from France," I tell her as if this might clarify matters, "and this is not French cheese." The girl looks at me with unconcealed contempt. You are not supposed to complain in restaurants like this one. You are not supposed to notice the food in restaurants like this one, any more than you notice the streets you hurry through, latte in hand, back to your computer. The screen, the phone, that disembodied world is the one we truly inhabit. The International Financial Services Center is merely a frame for it. An outline, the equivalent of the chalk marks of a child's game on the pavement.
"You want change?"
the girl taunts me. I raise my hands in surrender and, cheeks burning, turn away. Only then do I realize the man in black is standing right behind me. Around us, the cafe has returned to normal life. The sullen girl rings up another panini, the office workers drink their uniquely tailored coffees. I goggle at Ish at the nearby table, but she doesn't seem to notice. Nor does anyone else, as if the stranger has cast some cloak of invisibility over us. Blinding white light pours through the open door. He gazes at me, his eyes a terrifying ice blue.
"Claude,"
he says. He knows my name, of course he does. "What do you want from me?" I try to sound defiant, but my voice will not come in more than a whisper.
"Just to talk,"
he says. "You have the wrong man," I say. "I have not done anything."
"That makes you the right man," he says. A smile spreads slowly across his chops. That makes you exactly the right man.
His name is Paul. He is a writer.
I've been shadowing you for a project I'm working on. I had no idea you'd spotted me. I hope I didn't alarm you.
I was not alarmed, I lie. Although these days one must be careful, there are a lot of people very angry at bankers.
Well, I can only apologize again. And lunch is definitely on me. Ah, here we go.
The waitress appears, dark and genial as her counterpart in the fake French cafe was blonde and cold, and sets down two bowls of freshly made sorrel soup. We have crossed the plaza back to the Arc, and this time found a table.
I can see why you like this place,
he says, dipping a hunk of bread into his soup.
The food's fantastic, and I love all this nautical stuff.
Nodding at the portholes, the great anchor by the door.
It's like going on a boat ride.
He purses his lips and blows on the bread. He doesn't appear to be in any great hurry to tell me why we are here.
So you are a writer? I say. What kind of things do you write?
A few years back I wrote a novel,
he says.
Called For Love of a Clown.
This prompts a faint ringing at the back of my mind. Some kind of prize?
You're thinking of The Clowns of Sorrow by Bimal Banerjee, which won the Raytheon? My novel came out around the same time, similar enough subject matter. It did all right, but when the time came to begin the next one, I found I'd hit a kind of wall. Started asking myself some really hard questions. What's the novel for? What place does it have in the modern world? All that. For a long time I was stuck, really and truly stuck. Then out of nowhere it came to me. Idea for a new book. The whole thing right there, like a baby left on the doorstep.
And what is it about? I ask politely.
What's it about?
Paul smiles.
Well, it's about you, Claude. It's about you.
I am too surprised to conceal it.
Me? I've been studying you in your daily routine for a number of weeks now. It seems to me that your life embodies certain values, certain fundamental features of our modern world. We're living in a time of great change, and a man like you is right at the coalface of that change.
I do not think that my life would make a very interesting book, I say. I feel I can speak with a certain amount of authority here. He laughs.
Well, in a way, that's the point. The stories we read in books, what's presented to us as being interesting, they have very little to do with real life as it's lived today. I'm not talking about straight-up escapism, your vampires, serial killers, codes hidden in paintings and so on. I mean so-called serious literature. A boy goes hunting with his emotionally volatile father, a bereaved woman befriends an asylum seeker, a composer with a rare neurological disorder walks around New York thinking about the nature of art. People looking back over their lives, people having revelations, people discovering meaning. Meaning, that's the big thing. The way these books have it, you trip over a rock, you'll find some hidden meaning waiting there. Everyone's constantly on the verge of some soul-shaking transformation, and it's, if you'll forgive my language, it's bullshit. Modern people live in a state of distraction. They go from one distraction to the next, and that's how they like it. They don't transform. They don't stop to smell the roses. They don't sit around recollecting long passages of their childhood. Jesus, I can hardly remember what I was doing 2 days ago. My point is, people aren't waiting to be restored to some ineffable moment. They're not looking for meaning. That whole idea of the novel, that's finished.
So you want to write a book that has no meaning? I say.
I want to write a book that isn't full of things that only ever happen in books,
he says.
I want to write something that genuinely reflects how we live today. Real, actual life, not some ivory tower palaver, not a whole load of literature. What's it like to be alive in the 21st century? Look at this place, for example.
He sweeps an arm at the window, the glass anonymity of the International Financial Services Center.
We're in the middle of Dublin, where Joyce set Ulysses, but it doesn't look like Dublin. We could be in London or Frankfurt or Kuala Lumpur. There are all these people, but nobody's speaking to each other. Everyone's just looking at their phones, and that's what this place is for. It's a place for being somewhere else. Being here means not being here, and that's modern life. I see, I say, although I don't quite.
So the question is, how do you describe it? If James Joyce was writing Ulysses today, if he was writing not about some 19th century backwater, but about the capital of the most globalized country in the world, where would he begin? Who would his Bloom be? His everyman.
He looks at me pointedly, but it takes me a moment to realize the import of his words. You think I am an everyman? He makes a hey presto gesture with his hands. But I'm not even Irish, I protest. How can I be your typical Dubliner? He shakes his head vigorously.
That's key. Like I said, somewhere else is what this place is all about. Think about it. In your work, you have colleagues from all over the place, right?
That's true.
And the cleaning staff are from all over the place, and the waitresses in this restaurant are from all over the place. Modern life is a centrifuge. It throws people in every direction. That's why you're so perfect for this book. The everyman's uprooted. He's alone. He's separated from his friends and family. And the work that you do, you're a banker, isn't that so?
Yes, an analyst at Bank of Torabundo. I say before it occurs to me how strange it is that he knows this.
Well,
he spreads his hands to signify self-evidence.
I hardly need to say how representative that is. The story of the 21st century so far is the story of the banks. Look at the mess this country is in because of them.
Ah, I begin to understand. So your book will be a kind of exposé?
No, no, no. He says, waving his hands as if to dispel some evil-smelling smoke. I don't want to write a takedown. I'm not interested in demonizing an entire industry because of the actions of a minority. I want to get past the stereotypes, discover the humanity inside the corporate machine. I want to show what it's like to be a modern man. And this is where he lives. Not on a fishing trawler, not in a coal mine, not on a ranch in Wyoming. This!
He gestures once again to the window, and we both turn in our seats to contemplate the reticular expanse of the center, the blank facades of the multinationals.
Is where modern life comes from. The feel of it, the look of it, everything. What happens inside those buildings defines how we live our lives, even if we only notice when it goes wrong. The banks are like the heart, the engine room, the world within the world. The stuff that comes out of these places.
Whirling a finger again at the center.
The credit, the deals, that's what our reality is made of. So with that in mind, can you think of a better subject for a book than you?
Essentially, he tells me, the process would be a more intensive version of what he has been doing already. Following me around, observing at close quarters, focusing as much as possible on my work for the bank.
What would I have to do?
You wouldn't have to do anything, Paul says. Just be yourself. Just be.
He glances at the bill, takes a note from his wallet and lays it on the plate.
I don't expect you to make a decision like this on the spot. To lay yourself out for a perfect stranger, that's a big thing to ask. I wish I could say you'd be handsomely rewarded, but right now all I could offer is the dubious honour of providing material for a book that might never get published.
He cracks a grin.
Still, I bet the girls in the office would be interested to find out you're a character in a work of fiction.
How do you mean?
Think about it. Heathcliff, Mr. Darcy, Captain Ahab even. Women go nuts for them.
Although those characters are imaginary, I say slowly.
Exactly, but you'll be real, do you see? It's like you'll be getting the best of both worlds.
As if to bear out his words, the beautiful dark-haired waitress flashes me a smile as she glides past. My head is spinning, and it really is time for me to get back to the office, but there is still one question he has not answered.
Why me? There are 30,000 people working in the IFSC. Why did you choose me?
To be honest, that's what caught my eye initially, he says.
That? Oh!
I realize he's pointing at my jacket, which I am in the course of slipping back on.
The black really stands out, especially with the tie. Most people here seem to go for grey. Must be a French thing, is it?
Yes, I say, it's a French thing.
Makes you look very literary, he says.
And when I got closer, I could see you had a certain,
I don't know, sensibility. I got the impression that you were different from the others, that you weren't just going through the motions, that you were searching for something, maybe. It's hard to explain.
He reaps a scrap of paper from a little red notebook and scribbles down his number.
Look, he says, I could be completely wrong, but I think there's a really important book to be written about this place, and I think you'd be perfect for it. If it doesn't feel right for you, for whatever reason, I promise I'll disappear from your life. But can I ask you at least to think about it?
Here he is, Jürgen says as I enter the research department. We were beginning to think we must send out the search party.
Where do you disappear to? Ish inquires through a mouthful of paperclips.
Nowhere, I shrug. I ran into someone and went for a coffee.
Casual day,
Jürgen shakes his head.
Anything can happen.
Kimberly comes in from reception.
Claude, Ryan Colchis called about some numbers on a Ukrainian outfit you were digging up for him.
Okay, I say.
And Walter's PA called to say he's coming in.
There goes your weekend, Ish says.
I sit down at my terminal, confront the wall of fresh emails. Already the writer and his strange proposal are beginning to seem distant and unreal, one of those hazy episodes you can't be sure you didn't dream. And yet the familiar objects of the office have acquired a curious sheen, appear to resonate somehow like enchanted furniture in a fairy tale that will dance around the room as soon as you turn your back.
Hey, has Claude heard the news?
Kevin calls from his desk.
What news?
I say with a curious feeling of, what, synchronicity? As though someone is looking over my shoulder.
Blankley's the new CEO,
he says.
Rachel's office just sent down word.
Blankley got it, I say. Well, well.
Things will be changing, Claude, Jürgen says. This is the whole new beginning of the Bank of Torabundo story.
Yes, I say, and then I should call Colchis.
Are you feeling better?
Ish catches my arm. You looked a bit off earlier.
Yes, yes, I just needed some air, I tell her, but she is not deterred. She continues to scrutinize me.
Are you sure? She says. You seem, I don't know, different somehow.
Claude is never different, Jürgen says, clapping me on the shoulder. Claude is always the same.
Yeah.
He wrinkles her nose thoughtfully, and I turn my eyes to the screen as if I have a secret to keep.
The Pareto Principle, also known as the 80-20 rule, is one of the first things you learn in banking. For any given area of life, 80% of the effects come from 20% of the causes. Thus, 80% of your profits come from 20% of your clients. 80% of your socializing is with 20% of your friends. 80% of the music you listen to is from 20% of your library, etc. The idea is to minimize the gray zone that devours your day. The 80% of your reading, for instance, that yields only 20% of your information. Walter Corliss is very much aware what side of the rule he's on. He knows he is the wealthiest and most powerful man you have ever met, and as such demands 100% of your time and attention. A meeting with, or even a call from Walter, is like some supermassive planet materializing in your little patch of space, blocking the sun, overwhelming your gravitational field so that you can only watch as the entire structure of your world goes hurtling off to rearrange itself on his. He started off selling turf from the back of a flatbed truck. 30 years later, he is chairman and CEO of one of the biggest construction companies in the British Isles. Even the worldwide slump hasn't hurt him. While his peers put all their chips into housing, Dublex diversified into transport, logistics, and most profitably, high-security developments, military compounds, fortifications, prisons, which, as unrest sweeps across Europe and Asia, constitute a rare growth area. That a company he named after his daughter now builds enhanced interrogation facilities in Belarus gives a good indication of the man's attitudes to business and life in general. That daughter, Lexi, now runs a string of nursing homes known informally as the Glue Factory. His driver calls me shortly after 6. I go outside to find Walter's limo parked, in contravention of all the center's rules, on the plaza in front of Transaction House. Walter is sprawled across the back seat. He stares at me as I squeeze into the fold-down seat opposite him, breathing heavily through his nose.
He is a dour, grey-faced man who looks like he was dug up from the same bog he got his first bags of turf. Newspaper profiles refer to his drive and his focus, but these are euphemisms. What Walter has is the dead-eyed relentlessness of the killer in a horror movie, the kind that lumber after you inexorably, heedless of knives, bullets, flamethrowers. Though his fortune runs into the billions and he employs a team of accountants in tax havens around the world, he still enjoys calling on his debtors personally. And the pockets of his coat are always full of checks, bank drafts, rolls of notes in rubber bands. Sometimes he'll present me with a fistful with instructions to invest in this or that. This is not strictly my job, but then Walter doesn't care what my job is. Or rather, as our biggest client, he knows that my job is whatever he says it is. Tonight he wants to ask my thoughts on a tender. Dublex has been approached by the Interior Ministry of the Middle Eastern Autocracy of Oran to fortify the private compound of the Caliph. They are expecting trouble, I ask. Walter just grunts. He knows, of course, he has specialists in every conceivable field, but he still likes to canvass opinions from as wide a spectrum as possible before making a decision in order, Ish says, to maximize the number of people he can yell at if something goes wrong.
Is there money in this fucker's pocket, is what I'm asking you, he says.
It's one of the biggest oil producers in the region. I imagine his credit is good, I say.
Walter scowls. I tell him I'll look into it, and he signals his approval by changing the subject, launching into a familiar tirade about regulations.
When we are done, I return to my apartment, where I can finally start investigating the mysterious writer in earnest. Searching online, I discover that the novel he mentioned, For Love of a Clown, is real. An image search confirms in a picture that shows him shaking hands with a giant papaya at something called the Donard Exotic Fruits and Book Festival that its author and the man who approached me are one and the same. His Apeiron page has two customer write-ups, both negative. The first compares his clown-themed novel unfavorably to Bimal Banerjee's The Clowns of Sorrow and gives it a rating of 2 snakes and a cactus. The second offers no rating at all and consists solely of the line, "On no account should you lend money to this man." Beyond that, there is nothing. As far as the wider world is concerned, for the last 7 years he might as well not have existed, which is consistent with what he told me about hitting a wall. I go on to my balcony, try to look out with the eyes of a novelist. My apartment is in the International Financial Services Center, a stone's throw from the bank. The city center lies upriver. If I lean over the rail, I can glimpse the spire jutting into the darkness like a radio transmitter from the heart of things. But it's only on rare evenings when the wind is blowing in a particular direction that I hear its broadcasts, the whoops, the screams, the laughter and fights, and even then only faintly, like the revelry of ghosts. Usually, when night has fallen and only a few lights remain, checkering the dark slabs of the buildings, it is easy, looking over the deserted concourse, to believe the world has upped stakes and gone, followed the baton of trade west, leaving me here alone. Before I came here, I knew little about Dublin. I had an idea it was famous for its dead writers. I remember the name of the river from arguments in school about whether it's Liffey or Lethe, the singer floats down in How to Disappear Completely. I entertained vague notions about Guinness and authenticity. It turned out to be very different from what I expected. At university, I had read about the virtual, the simulated world that abuts and interpenetrates our own, real without being actual, present without being there, in the words of the philosopher François Texier. I didn't think after graduating that I would require the concept again. I certainly never dreamed I'd find myself living in it. That said, there is some argument as to whether the International Financial Services Center is truly part of Dublin. It lies only a few minutes' walk from O'Connell Street, but the locals don't come here. Many of them don't even seem to know it exists, in spite of the torrents of capital that flow into it every year. It was built 20 years ago as a kind of pacemaker, an ingenious piece of financial and legal technology embedded in Dublin's 1,000-year-old body. A jumble of stumpy glass buildings, it stretches along the river like a pygmy Manhattan, on what used to be the docklands. Its main function is to be a kind of legal elsewhere. Multinationals send their profits here to avoid tax. Banks conduct their more sensitive activities with the guarantee of a blind eye from the authorities.
Many of the companies here have billions in assets but no employees. The foyer of Transaction House is crowded with brass nameplates, all leading to a single, permanently empty office. They call this shadow banking, and the IFSC is a shadow place, an alibi that will say you are here when you are not, and cover your presence when you don't want to be seen. Could you really set a book in such a place? In a city that is not a city, filled with people who are paid not to be themselves. He says he wants to find the humanity inside the machine, to track down the particular amid the golden abstractions. He said he can see something different about me. And standing on the balcony, I thrill at the thought that I might see it too. But what if he's wrong? What if he holds up the mirror and nothing is there? Jürgen shares none of my reservations.
An author?
He exclaims, when I mention it casually after the Monday meeting.
A real-life author? And he wants to put you in his book?
Yes, I say.
You,
Kevin the trainee says. I shrug. It seems that I just fit the bill, is that the phrase? In fact, I know perfectly well it is the phrase.
Do you think he'll put us in it as well?
I don't know, I say. I will ask him.
Doesn't it sound a bit weird?
Ish is more circumspect.
Some bloke following you around, writing down everything you do. What's weird is that it hasn't happened before,
Kevin says.
When you think about it, there ought to be a lot more novelists wanting to write books about banks.
But he's not planning to slag us off, is he? He says.
You know, say we're all wankers and fat cats and so on.
He told me it was going to be a balanced account of life in a modern investment bank, I tell her. He said he wanted to find our hidden humanity.
It's about time bankers were recognized by the art world, Jürgen says. Given that we buy most of the actual art, it is frustrating to be continually misrepresented by it.
So are you going to do it? Ish asks. I haven't decided, I say.
You have to do it, Kevin expostulates. Tell him I'll do it if you don't want to. As your superior, I think you should do it, Claude,
Jürgen agrees.
Though, of course, the final decision remains with you.
He adds that while I am making up my mind, he will get the ball rolling by running it by the chief operating officer. Before I can protest, he has trundled away. Maybe Rachel will say no. I decide to put it out of my mind until I hear back. I return to my desk, feel the familiar thrill in my viscera as I sit down in front of the terminal. Here is the market. The whole world represented in figures, a tesseract of pure information. The media like to portray bankers as motivated purely by greed, but this is not quite accurate.
There are those who do it for the money, it's true, who, like miners or deep-sea divers, bury themselves miles below the surface of things, far from the light and everything they love in order to return laden down with riches.
But there are others who do it for the God's eye view. Those for whom the map has become the territory, for whom the market's operations, as represented on the screen, appear more complex than life itself, deeper and more intricate, bringing their own vertiginous intelligence to the brute facts of the world in the same way that a painting of a landscape magnifies its beauty by placing in a frame of consciousness the thoughtless doings of nature. For these latter sort, the highs of the best drugs are shadows next to the exhilaration they get from shifting fields of numbers. Rice growers in Henan, car manufacturers in Dusseldorf, pharmaceutical research firms in Cork and Montevideo, condensed, compressed, interacting with each other in ways which they themselves have no conception, like molecules hurtling and dancing and colliding under a microscope. Ish is an anomaly. Not of the God's eye view sort, but not especially interested in money either, other than what she needs to pay for her apartment, which she bought off the plans during the boom at a price she now admits may have been extravagant even for an investment banker.
Any word from the Uncanny Valley? She asks me now.
You are sitting here beside me. You know there is no word.
All right.
A moment later, she pipes up again.
Hey, Claude.
If this is a question about the book, the answer is, I don't know.
It's not about the book, it's about the movie of the book.
Well, if they make a film of it, will I get to say who plays me? I mean, I don't want them to pick some old boot.
The morning drags on with no response from Rachel. Shortly before noon, however, a shadow looms up behind me.
Crazy frog, what the cock are you telling Costis about Termalat?
I am telling them that Termalat is carrying heavy exposure to Greek sovereign debt, I reply, and there's no way they're going to hit their target.
I'm trying to sell them Termalat, you fucking dunce.
The muscles on his neck, which are extensive, bunch out like the mast lines of a ship at full sail.
I've got 200 of the cons going at 12 and a quarter.
My source says their income's down nearly 30% on this same period last year. A write-down of Greek debt can cost them 100 million. Your customers will thank you for sparing them.
That's not going to get us commission, is it?
He scowls. Fucking Greek pricks, he mutters. Why couldn't they stick to...
What is it Greeks are good at again?
Inventing democracy? Ish suggests.
They've been dining out on that for a long time, Howie retorts.
Howie Hogan does not look like a genius. 25 and hitting the gym hard every day, he still has a childish doughiness to his features, giving him the appearance of one of those overfed, unimaginative rich boys who see the world as a kind of third-rate in-flight movie, to which they will pay attention only until they reach their real destination. This is, in fact, exactly what he is. But he is also BOT's star trader. Beside mathematical acuity, sharp reflexes, and an ability to get people to buy things they don't want, Howie is gifted with almost total emotional dissociation. Other traders freak out, crack up, crash and burn. Howie's only reaction, win or lose, is to smirk. I am fairly sure he smirks in his sleep. What is he doing here? He should be in London at one of the bulge brackets, making 10 times what he does at BOT, but some indiscretion in his past, details of which none of us has ever been able to establish, means he must get to the top the hard way. Having chastised me for undermining Sellside, he would normally have lumbered off by now. Instead, he is still hovering.
"What's this fucking bullshit I'm hearing?" he says at last.
Close and Coulthard's merger has been held up by the CMA, I say. I end you.
Now about someone writing your autobiography.
Oh, that. The smirk flickers.
Who the fuck would want to write a book about you?
Howie says. An author, I say expressionlessly.
For your information, he thinks Claude would make the perfect everyman,
Ish pitches in. Howie laughs.
Every man, he repeats. Who's that, the world's most boring superhero?
Isn't there a harassment hearing you need to be at? Ish says.
Look out, supervillains. Every man's super spreadsheet has the power to bore you to death.
Howie struts away, still cackling.
Claude in a book. Who says the French have no sense of humour?
Don't mind him, Claude. He's just jealous, Ish says.
Do people say the French have no sense of humour? I ask her.
Of course not, she says, patting my hand. I return to my work, but this brief conversation has been enough to reawaken my fears. Howie is right. I don't have a story. I don't have time to have a story. I have organised my life here precisely in order not to have a story. Why would I want someone following me around, weighing me up, finding me lacking? I take out my wallet, unfurl the scrap of paper on which Paul scrawled his number, but before I can call him and pass on my regrets, Jürgen approaches from the direction of the meeting rooms.
Claude, good news!
He grins at me with excitement.
Rachel has given the okay for your book project.
Oh, I say, surprised.
You must call your author right away,
he exhorts me.
I will,
I say.
Right away!
He repeats.
Yes,
I say. He stands there waiting. Without even wanting to, I see him as an outsider might, taking his pocket protector, his hideous tie, his strange plasticated hair that never seems to grow any longer. Is he happy? Lonely? Bored? Do any of these terms even apply? First, I have a small errand to do, I say,
I go to the lift and hit the button for the ground floor. As I descend, I turn the decision over in my mind. He's not writing a book about me, I remind myself. He's shadowing me for research purposes. I am a highly successful employee at a highly successful bank. There is no reason to fear that he will find my life boring or empty. The lift doors open. The security guards glance over, then away almost immediately. Outside, the air is perfectly still. Workers clip back and forth in the windows of the buildings around me, a silent image of productivity. Yet across the river, the grey shell of Royal Irish Bank is populated only by seagulls. And just last week, a German bank two floors below us imploded. We watched from above as the erstwhile employees filed out through the double doors, blinking in the light, clinging to cardboard boxes full of mouse mats and ficuses, casting up their eyes at the bright opaque windows as if to a land that was lost to them. Paul answers on the second ring. It's me, I say. Claude. There is a curious echo to the line, as if someone is listening in, and I have the strangest sense he already knows what I am going to say. But the sound of his voice is warm and human, not the voice of a god or an omniscient overseer.
How are you, buddy?
I'm well, thank you. I'm calling to tell you that my boss has given the green light for your project.
Fantastic.
His delight sounds genuine, which produces a proportionally opposite effect in me as I consider the fall for which he is setting himself up. So what exactly do you need me to do now? I say.
Like I told you, Claude, I don't need you to do anything. Just be yourself.
All right.
I promise. It won't be intrusive. You'll barely notice I'm there.
Very good.
You don't sound too excited.
No, no, I am, I say, but then impetuously add, it's not very dramatic, you know.
What's that?
What we do in the bank, it is quite complex and technical. If you're looking for colourful characters, for exciting things to happen, it may seem rather... I don't know if it will give you what you need. Laughter comes back down the line.
Don't you worry about that.
I'm the artist, okay. It's my job to go in there and find the gold, wherever it's hidden.
You think there will be gold? I say.
I'm sure of it, Claude. I'm sure of it.
To me, of course, it is unquestionably dramatic. To me, to anyone working in banking, the last 2 years have been like the fall of Rome, the French Revolution, the South Sea Bubble, and the moon landing, all rolled into one. For half a decade, since in fact the previous financial crisis, which at that point represented the greatest destruction of capital in history, the world had been living on borrowed money. Wages went down, but credit was cheap. You were getting paid less, but borrowing the money to replace your car, take a holiday, buy a new house was easy. The banks themselves were borrowing money at enormous rates, taking it from megabanks in Europe and lending it out again at a nice margin to you with your car, to the entrepreneur with his start-out, to the developer with his housing estate. As for the governments, they were content to let this happen because everyone was so happy with their cars and holidays and houses. And of course the governments too were borrowing hugely to fund the services that workers' taxes no longer paid for. In short, the whole world was massively in debt. But it didn't seem to matter. Then, suddenly, almost overnight, it did. Someone, somewhere, realized that the global boom was in fact a pyramid scheme. A huge, inflammable pyramid waiting to catch light. Investors panicked and began to pull their money out of megabanks. The megabanks desperately began to call in loans from the regional banks. The regional banks called in loans from their customers. The customers called in loans from their trading partners, or tried to, though all of a sudden, no one was answering their phones. The consequences of this cataclysmic freeze-up of credit are still unfolding. Around the world, banks have been falling like ninepins, illustrious financial dynasties blown away like smoke. In the United States, Bear Stearns, Merrill Lynch, Lehman Brothers are among the major casualties, while in Ireland, the high street banks are still trading only after a government bailout. That bailout, in turn, has triggered a catastrophic series of events. Factories shutting down, homes repossessed, mass immigration, nearly 400,000 people from a country with a population less than half the size of the Paris metropolitan area.
Every day on the news there is another horror story. The pensioner who has been living on pigeons. The horses whose owners can no longer afford stable fees and have turned them loose to wander the byways, slowly starving to death. Nothing the politicians do seems to help. In Greece, in Spain, in Portugal, in Italy, public fury mounts and revolution is in the air. Buy to the sound of cannons, sell to the sound of trumpets, the saying goes. If you have positioned yourself correctly, there is a lot of money to be made. At 4 a.m., I give up trying to sleep. I have a cup of coffee, then cross over to use the gym in the basement of Transaction House. Two traders on the Smith machines are anticipating how BOT strategy will change with the new CEO in charge, bragging about how much money they will make once they're off the chain, how ruthlessly they will fuck rivals from other banks. Upstairs, Thomas Yuan McGregor and his Asian markets team are already at their desks. I take advantage of the early start to read through the headlines, the latest prognostications of doom for Europe. The sun creeps through the window, faces appear in the lobby, still puffy with sleep. Slowly at first, then in a flurry, the day's small rituals begin. The tray of coffees delivered by the rain-speckled intern. The baffling jokes in the inbox amid endless emails flagged, urgent, high priority, read immediately. The collective groan at the sight of the courier with his package of amendments, redos, overnight changes of heart. As 8 a.m. approaches, the tension mounts. Positioning themselves for the market opening, traders call constantly, looking for updates, price-sensitive developments, anything that will give them the edge over the invisible hordes doing exactly the same thing here and across the water. Soon the entire research floor is speaking intensely into phones, everyone completely oblivious to everyone else, eyes fixed instead on screens or on that empty point in midair where so much of life now takes place. It seems you can actually feel the market straining like a dog on a leash for the moment trading begins. The first couple of hours pass in a blur. After that, things begin to relax a little. I have arranged to meet Paul at 10. Ish and Jürgen want to come downstairs with me, but I prevail upon them to stay where they are. He wants to see my life as it is every day, I say. Everything must be natural. All right, they say reluctantly and slouch off in the direction of their desks. Riding down the lift, I am surprised at how nervous I feel. It's the same kind of anxiety that used to spring up years ago as I made my way to a rendezvous with some girl I had fallen in love with, knowing that today was the day I had to make my feelings clear, knowing simultaneously that I wouldn't do it. And when the lift doors open and I find the foyer empty, the lurch of despair is familiar too. I check my phone, but there is no word. Has he changed his mind? Was he merely having some fun at my expense? I hover by the doors, pretending I don't notice the security guards glare at me from their desk. And then I see him, hurrying over the rainy plaza, and just as it did at the appearance of Sylvie or Valou or Aimé or the others, I feel my heart soar. He smiles at me brittlely, apologizes for being late. He looks almost as nervous as I am. I tell him not to worry and bring him over to the security desk. There are various forms for him to fill in. Then he is told to stand still while the guard photographs him, takes his fingerprints, scans his iris. For a long moment we wait in silence as the guard stares at a screen we cannot see. Then he sighs, and there is a clunking sound, and he reaches down to produce Paul's pass.
"Thought that guy was going to ask for a blood sample,"
Paul says as we turn away for the lift.
"Yes," I say.
The lift takes a long time to arrive. Finally, the doors part, and I press the button for the sixth floor. "We are on the sixth floor," I say redundantly.
"Right,"
Paul says. We ascend. I search for some fact or detail that might be useful to him, or at least break the silence.
"Otis," I say.
"Excuse me?"
"The lift, it is manufactured by Otis. They are one of the most famous lift producers."
"Yes."
"That does not necessarily mean they are the best. Of course, still, this particular lift has, in my experience, always been very reliable."
"That's good to know."
"I presume that Otis was the name of the inventor, though it might have been simply a name he made up. Perhaps you know."
"No, I can't say I do."
"There is the option of the stairs also," I add, "but usually I take the lift."
"Right,"
he says. Quel con. I'm half expecting that when we reach the sixth floor, he'll thank me for my time and ride back down to the ground again. It's with some relief that I find Ish and Jürgen standing in the lobby, pretending to have an intense conversation about the potted plant by reception.
It's that fine line between watering it too much and not watering it enough, Ish is saying. Then a hush falls as we step inside. The two of them stare expectantly at the two of us, and my anxiety gives way to an upsurge of pride.
Ish, Jürgen, this is Paul, I say to them carelessly. He will be my shadow in the office for the next few weeks. Paul, may I introduce you, my colleague Ish and Jürgen, the financial institution's team leader.
Hello,
Paul says. We all smile at each other awkwardly for a minute. Then, just as I'm about to lead him away, Ish asks Paul quickly, as if she cannot help herself.
Are you really a rada?
For my sins, Paul says.
Wow,
Ish murmurs. I roll my eyes at Jürgen, only to see an identical expression of schoolgirlish reverence.
A writer, he says. It must be so exciting.
Beats working, I suppose, Paul says.
I hear that,
Jürgen says. He looks down at his shoes and then adds casually,
in fact, I'm being a little disingenuous, as I know something about being a writer myself from my work with Florin Affairs, the Journal of Medieval Economics. Perhaps you have heard of it?
Paul makes a show of racking his brains.
It's not to be confused with Foreign Affairs, which is the Journal of the Hungarian Currency.
Right, Paul says.
If I may say so, you have made an excellent choice of subject,
Jürgen goes on.
Bank of Turabundo is one of the most fascinating institutions in all of capital allocation, and Claude is one of its most valued employees.
He pauses, then turns to Ish.
Though all our employees are valued, he says.
I'm Claude's best mate in this dump,
Ish volunteers.
Which is funny, because people say that frogs and Aussies don't get on, because the frogs are all, you know, shmee, 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 and the Aussies are like, well, hey, but we get on like a house on fire, don't we, Claude?
I picture the flames, the screaming. Yes, I say.
Anyway, if you want to know his secrets, you know who to come to.
Claude's got secrets? Paul eyes me with a half smile.
There's a drawer of carom bars, Ish says. That's the tip of the iceberg.
We should definitely talk, Paul says. I will show Paul the rest of the office, I tell them meaningfully.
If you're writing about him, you have to put me in the book too, Ish calls after us. Only if you do, say I'm a size 8.
I tug him away. Eyes glance over us with carefully prearranged expressions of indifference as we cross the room. It seems everyone has heard about the visitor. So this is the research floor, I tell him, gesturing broadly at the clocks on the walls, the muted televisions, the cubicles crowded with screens, phones, paperwork.
Where are all the guys shouting at each other?
The traders work upstairs on the seventh floor, but we're in contact with them all day. Part of our job is to provide them with information on the securities they're trading in, the key drivers affecting share price, any relevant developments in the sector.
Is that Turabundo?
Paul points to a print hanging by one of the southerly windows, a verdant square of lush forests and effulgent sunshine.
It's an island, right?
It is basically an extinct volcano in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, I say. A big extinct volcano with an extremely benevolent tax climate.
Ever been?
No, the headquarters are registered there, but most of our operations are directed from New York. So, as I was saying, our role here is to study the market on behalf of our traders and also to advise the clients of the best investment strategy.
Someone's got some pretty interesting desk ornaments,
Paul says, eyeing the cornucopia of shells, feathers, figurines, and other relics that festoon the cubicle next to mine. Yes, those belong to Ish, I say, experiencing simultaneously a flush of gratitude that he finds something in our environment interesting and a pang of jealousy that it should be Ish. She spent a couple of years travelling around Oceania.
How'd she end up here?
I believe she started at the bank shortly after she split with her fiancé. She will no doubt tell you the story herself.
Came here to forget, eh?
Paul says as he examines a shark jawbone.
Like the French Foreign Legion,
he turns to me.
What about you, Claude? You here to forget too?
I flinch inwardly, but keep my expression neutral. You can make the argument that we have all come here to forget, I say, although in most cases before anything has actually happened to us.
Nice,
he murmurs to himself, and taking from his back pocket his little red notebook, he jots down the line. So if you look at this terminal here, I say, pretending I have not noticed, you will see the very latest market information, and this one...
You know what, Claude? I don't want too much detail. It'll overload it. Why don't you just get back to what it is you do?
I'll pick it up by watching you. It's better that way. Are you sure? I say dubiously.
Please,
he says, with an ushering gesture towards my chair.
Just forget I'm here.
Right, I say, taking my seat and feeling foolishly as if I am an astronaut strapping himself into the cockpit of a rocket. Paul crosses the room and sits in an unoccupied chair. Here, from a distance of about 20 feet away, he crosses his legs, lays the pad on his lap, affixes his eyes on me, and waits. So I will continue with my morning call around, I turn to tell him. This is where we give our clients the state of play in the market and the movement we are expecting.
Honestly, I'll pick it up.
Yes, of course, sorry. I summon a deep breath. Just be, I tell myself. Around me, my colleagues are making their own calls, each passing on his own predictions for his own particular specialism. Oil, utilities, telecoms. Clients pay tens of thousands for this daily service, but usually we go straight through to voicemail. So I'm taken aback when someone actually picks up. Hello? He says.
Hello, I have forgotten who I called.
Is that Claude?
Hello,
possibly it is Jim Chen. Hello, Jim! Hello! He says, not contradicting me. Relief courses through me until I realize I have also forgotten what I wanted to say. It's about the market, I say. That seems like a safe bet. Yes? Jim Chen says. But what about the market? My mind has gone completely blank. I am just getting some news over the wires. I will call you back, I say. Okay, whatever, Jim Chen says. I put down the receiver. My shirt is soaked in sweat.
Claude,
a voice calls across the room. I revolve my head to see the silhouette of Paul against the window.
You're trying too hard,
he says.
I know, I say. Stop thinking about it. This is not so easy as it looks, I say. Just pretend I'm not here. In fact, you know what? I'll go and roam around for a while, give you a chance to get into your stride.
Is there a coffee machine around here somewhere?
I give him directions to the canteen.
Do you want anything?
No, thank you,
I say. Paul passes out of sight.
Idiot.
I chastise myself. Just be, can't you? Yet even when he's left the room, the pressure is almost unbearable. I send an email to Ish and Jürgen begging them to find time for lunch this afternoon. Then the phone rings. It is Gerlit, one of my clients. The board has called an emergency meeting for this afternoon after hearing rumors of an incipient takeover bid. How robust are its finances? Will it be able to fight off its attackers? For an hour and a half, I am continuously on the phone, during which time I quite forget to be. Then, with a start, I remember. I look around hastily. From his chair, Paul nods at me and toasts me with his paper cup. Before we know it, it's lunchtime, and Paul and I are back in the lift going down. Everything is all right? I ask. You are not finding it too dull?
Are you joking? It's perfect.
We push through the double doors.
So many people,
Paul marvels. Yes, the spectacle can be a little overwhelming, I agree. The plaza is a sea of suits and twinsets, identically dressed men and women milling about like the CGI crowd in some blockbusting movie, there to portray the mundane reality that will be shattered when Godzilla's foot comes down. Although, as the companies this particular crowd spends its days working for constitute some of the most powerful forces in the world, it's perhaps closer to the truth to say that we are Godzilla. This seems to me a rather clever thought. I try to think of some way of introducing it into the conversation. Have you seen the film Godzilla? I ask.
No, Paul says. Of course he hasn't. He's an artist. Why would he waste his time with such pabulum?
Why do you ask? He says.
The lunchtime crowd here sometimes reminds me of Godzilla, I say.
Oh,
Paul says. The red notebook remains in his pocket.
Jürgen, Ish, and Kevin are already in the Ark.
You come here a lot,
Paul observes, taking his seat.
It's the only restaurant in the whole centre you can get freshly prepared organic food, Ish says.
That's why it's usually empty, Kevin says. That and the art.
He points to the canvas that hangs over our table, an enormous abstract that loosely resembles a crossword puzzle having sex with a pie chart.
Simulacrum 12?
Paul reads from the label underneath.
Ariadne Acheropoidos. Wow, what a name. You'd hardly need to actually paint at all with a name like that. It's like an artwork in itself.
I wouldn't call that a painting anyway,
Kevin says.
Right, and you'd know, Ish says.
Simulacrum 40.
Paul reads from the label of the painting at the next table, then leans back to squint at the adjacent alcove.
Simulacrum 59. Are they all called simulacrum? What's that about?
Obviously the work of someone with mental health issues,
Kevin says.
Probably all the organic food. You can't eat that much quinoa and stay normal.
There is a small throat-clearing noise. We look up to see the waitress has materialized at the table. It's the same girl who served Paul and me on Friday. Dark-haired, olive-skinned, rangy without quite being tall.
Ready to order?
I'll have the quinoa, Ish says.
And so will he, she adds, pointing to Kevin. When the waitress has gone, Jürgen asks Paul if he is getting good material.
I'm still finding my feet, Paul says. It'll take a few days, I suppose.
The world of banking is full of complexity, Jürgen agrees. But once you have understood the basics, you will find it a story as exciting as any thriller. Look at Bank of Torabundo. 3 years ago, we were the little minnows. Now we have become the big fish on the block.
I read something about that, Paul says. What happened?
A lot of our competitors were badly damaged by the financial crisis. Some collapsed entirely. Others judged too big to be allowed to fail were giving huge government bailouts. But BOT came through it untouched.
How come?
We managed to avoid exposure to toxic investments. Our CEO at the time was deeply suspicious of complex derivatives and forbade us to take big positions on those markets.
Or property, Ish said. He didn't like the look of the global property market, so that's another bullet we dodged.
The result, anyway, is that the bank has been, as one might say, punching above its weight.
You must be pretty grateful to your CEO,
Paul says.
Yes, Jürgen says, although he has just been fired.
Paul looks surprised.
Fired?
Yes, his conservative stance cost the bank a lot of investors.
Even though he was right?
There is a happy medium,
Jürgen says.
Between right and wrong.
Sir Colin's a smart guy, Kevin says, but definitely on the cautious side.
In some ways, he belonged to an earlier era of banking,
Jürgen concurs.
It is true that his skeptical attitude saved BOT from financial catastrophe, but once we had survived, the board felt a more audacious leader was needed in order to press home our advantage. The new chief executive was appointed only a few days ago. His name is Potter Blankley.
Even speaking his name seems to quicken the atmosphere. Our eyes glitter as if we were sharing some magical secret.
Sounds familiar,
Paul says, frowning.
He is quite a celebrated figure, Jürgen says. He joined BOT from Danfoss Blauer, which you may remember was one of the biggest casualties of the crash.
It needed a $50 billion rescue package from the US government, Kevin chips in eagerly. Then it was bought for a dollar by Takahashi Group.
This is the guy you made your new CEO.
Paul appears confused.
Isn't that like pulling the captain of the Titanic out of the water and asking him to skipper your catamaran?
He has proved he is a man not afraid to take chances, Jürgen says seriously. Sir Colin was very much a traditionalist. He had the classic view of the merchant or investment bank as a go-between, bringing together companies and investors for a fee. But in recent years, many investment banks have begun trading for themselves. That is, instead of just acting in their customers' interests, they also bet on the market with their own money using complicated financial instruments called derivatives.
A derivative is a contract derived from an underlying asset, I explain, seeing Paul's look of bewilderment. An asset being something you own, your house, your car, and so on. Instead of buying or selling the asset itself, a derivative allows you to do other kinds of deals based on it. For example, one simple kind of derivative is an option. This is a contract that gives me the right, but not the obligation, to buy something from you at an agreed price, at an agreed date, in the future. I am calculating that when the date comes, the price will be more than our agreed price.
Isn't that just a bet?
Paul says uncertainly.
If you do it in the bookies, it's a bet, he says. If you pay some 23-year-old in an Armani suit 200 grand to go to the window for you, it's a derivative.
Because there's no limit to how often derivatives can be sold back and forth, the market for them is astronomically bigger than the market for actual things. In fact, no one knows how big it is.
And these derivatives are what your Sir Colin didn't like the look of.
Exactly. Wall Street banks were using instruments so complex that almost nobody understood how they actually worked. When their bets turned bad, they lost literally trillions of dollars. Sir Colin's instincts were on that occasion proved right. However, the BOT board
wants to give it another shot. Paul concludes with a smile.
There is a feeling that things are different this time, Jürgen says.
Our share price has jumped 3 points since the news came out about Blankley, Kevin says. A lot of people in the office are talking about buying in now, taking out a loan even. If the price keeps going at this rate, you'd make it back in a couple of months.
Perhaps it is fate that has brought you here at this time,
Jürgen tells Paul.
To capture the bank at the moment of its metamorphosis from minor player into unstoppable banking force.
And nobody's worried about, say, history repeating itself? Paul asks.
History has already repeated with the last crisis, Jürgen says firmly. We do not think there will be any more repeating.